Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we explore new therapies to reduce pancreatitis risk in severe hypertriglyceridemia, advances in breast cancer treatment, and long-term results of gene therapy for hemophilia B. We discuss vision-threatening vascular emergencies, the mental health effects of firearm injury on families, and care for peripheral artery disease. We also follow a revealing diagnostic case in an older woman with respiratory failure. Perspectives reflect on hypertension control, immunization access, chronic disease policy, and on the inherited risk of disease. Olezarsen for managing severe hypertriglyceridemia and pancreatitis risk by Nicholas Marston from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia have an increased risk of acute pancreatitis. Two new studies evaluated the efficacy and safety of olezarsen, an antisense oligonucleotide targeting apolipoprotein C3 messenger RNA, in such patients. In these trials, more than 1,000 patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia were randomly assigned to receive monthly olezarsen at a dose of 50 milligrams or 80 milligrams, or placebo. The primary outcome was the percent change from baseline in the triglyceride level at 6 months. Acute pancreatitis events were assessed across both trials. Decreases in the levels of triglycerides, apolipoprotein C3, remnant cholesterol, and non-HDL cholesterol were greater with olezarsen than with placebo. The incidence of acute pancreatitis was also lower with olezarsen than with placebo. Elevations in liver enzyme levels and thrombocytopenia were more common with the 80 milligram dose of olezarsen, and a dose-dependent increase in the hepatic fat fraction was noted. Pamela Morris from the Medical University of South Carolina, Charleston, writes in an editorial that the results of the two trials by Marston and co-authors expand our understanding of the management of severe hypertriglyceridemia for reducing the risk of hypertriglyceridemia-induced acute pancreatitis. While olezarsen and plozasiran are currently approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of patients with familial chylomicronemia syndrome and extremely severe hypertriglyceridemia, that disorder is very rare. Multifactorial or polygenic hypertriglyceridemia is much more common, and the current findings inform treatment for this broader at-risk population of patients with this condition. Implementing management principles for these patients mandates careful attention to lifestyle intervention, identification and management of secondary causes of hypertriglyceridemia, and the administration of statin therapy in patients with an increased risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. The trials conducted by Marston and co-authors have now shown the benefits of olezarsen in reducing triglyceride levels and the risk of hypertriglyceridemia-induced acute pancreatitis in this vulnerable population. The next frontier will certainly involve exploring the role of new triglyceride-lowering therapies in reducing the risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Palbociclib for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-positive, advanced breast cancer by Otto Metzger from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. Standard first-line treatment for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-positive, metastatic breast cancer is dual anti-human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, HER2 therapy, plus chemotherapy, followed by maintenance treatment with HER2-targeted and endocrine therapies. Preclinical and clinical data suggest that adding palbociclib, a selective cyclin-dependent kinase 4 and 6 inhibitor, may overcome resistance to both endocrine and HER2-directed therapies. In this phase 3 trial, 518 patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer who did not have disease progression after 4 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy plus HER2 targeted therapy were randomly assigned to receive maintenance HER2 targeted and endocrine therapies with or without palbociclib. Adding palbociclib led to a significant improvement in progression-free survival over standard therapy, though with increased toxic effects, mainly neutropenia. A randomized trial of tenecteplase in acute central retinal artery occlusion by Stephen Ryan from the Oslo University Hospital, Norway, and co-authors. Central retinal artery occlusion is an ophthalmologic emergency that carries a high risk of permanent blindness if prompt reperfusion is not achieved. Patients typically present with sudden, painless, monocular vision loss and an afferent pupillary defect. Central retinal artery occlusion is typically caused by embolism from a carotid plaque or a cardiac thrombus, but it can result from any type of ischemic event. Despite various attempted interventions, no therapy has been shown to have clear efficacy in the initial treatment of the condition. In this phase 3 trial, 78 adults with acute non-arteritic central retinal artery occlusion who had symptom onset within 4.5 hours before treatment were randomly assigned to receive intravenous tenecteplase, a genetically modified tissue plasminogen activator, and oral placebo, or intravenous placebo and oral aspirin. The trial involved close collaboration between ophthalmologic departments and stroke units. Intravenous tenecteplase administered within 4.5 hours after onset of central retinal artery occlusion did not result in significantly greater vision recovery at 30 days than oral aspirin. There was a greater incidence of adverse events in the tenecteplase group, including one fatal intracranial hemorrhage. In an editorial, Matthew Schrag from Vanderbilt University Medical Center, Nashville, and Brian McGrory from Duke University, Durham, North Carolina, write that the key lessons from the current trial are that it is feasible to perform a high-quality trial of early treatments for central retinal artery occlusion when different specialists work in tandem, that future trials should give consideration to enrolling patients with a compelling clinical history, even when classic signs of central retinal artery occlusion are absent, and that rapid thrombolysis for central retinal artery occlusion should be assessed in a larger trial powered to detect clinically meaningful visual outcomes. Finally, given the continuing uncertainty of benefit with thrombolysis and the high stakes of potential long-term vision loss from central retinal artery occlusion, clinicians should consider a shared decision-making process to determine the most appropriate treatment strategies in patients with acute central retinal artery occlusion, because limited rehabilitation strategies are available for these patients, and the risk of complications associated with intravenous thrombolysis is relatively low. These editorialists believe thrombolysis should still be an available option in the right context: early treatment window, clear diagnosis, and low risk of bleeding. But the uncertain benefits and known risks of thrombolysis should be clearly communicated to patients. Final analysis of a study of etranacogene dezaparvovec for hemophilia B by Stephen Pipe from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and co-authors. Prophylactic treatment for hemophilia B necessitates lifelong regular intravenous factor IX infusions. Gene therapy offers the possibility of a single-dose treatment that produces durable endogenous factor IX expression and disease control. Etranacogene dezaparvovec comprises an adeno-associated virus serotype 5 vector and the highly active Padua factor 9 variant. The primary analysis of this study showed that etranacogene dezaparvovec reduced annualized bleeding rates, and adverse events were mainly of low grade in severity. The authors now report on the final data from 5 years of follow-up. Study participants with hemophilia B followed over the course of 5 years had a sustained endogenous factor 9 expression. Low annualized bleeding rates were also seen following the single infusion of etranacogene dezaparvovec. Mental health outcomes in children after parental firearm injury by George Carandinos from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Every year in the United States, approximately 20,000 youths lose a parent to firearm injury. Many more youths have parents who have sustained non-fatal firearm injuries. The effect of the parents' firearm injuries on their children's health and health care has been poorly understood. Using U.S. commercial health insurance claims data from the 2007 to 2022 period, these investigators identified 3,790 youths, 1 to 19 years of age, whose parents had received treatment for firearm injury and matched them with more than 18,000 controls. The investigators evaluated associations between parents' firearm injuries and the health, healthcare use, and medical spending of their children. Averaged over a year, parental firearm injury was associated with 8.4 additional psychiatric diagnoses per 1,000 youths and 23.1 additional mental health visits per 1,000 youths as compared with control. In youths with affected parents, the associated yearly increase was largest for diagnoses of trauma-related disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder, with an additional 8.5 diagnoses per 1,000 youths as compared with control, averaged over a year. Taken together, the findings emphasize the substantial within-family spillover effects of firearm injury. Peripheral artery disease in the legs. A review article by Mary McDermott from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago. Peripheral artery disease affects approximately 236 million persons worldwide and is diagnosed when the ankle brachial index is less than 0.9. Peripheral artery disease has major adverse effects on mobility. For example, a large study showed that among older persons, 3.3% of those without peripheral artery disease, 18.1% with mild disease, and 52% with severe disease could not complete a 6-minute walk test without resting. To prevent cardiovascular events in persons with peripheral artery disease, intensive cholesterol-lowering medications, statins, antiplatelet medications, or low-dose aspirin with rivaroxaban, blood pressure lowering to less than 130 over 80 millimeters mercury, and semaglutide are recommended, along with sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibitors in patients with diabetes. Supervised walking exercise and structured home-based walking exercise each improve walking ability in persons with peripheral artery disease. Revascularization in the legs should be reserved for those with persistent disease symptoms that do not respond to exercise. An 80-year-old woman with cough and hypoxemia. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Shreya Shrestha and colleagues. An 80-year-old woman was admitted to the hospital because of cough and hypoxemia with an oxygen saturation of 83%. Until 8 weeks earlier, she had been in her usual state of health, active in her community and biking to appointments, when a productive cough developed, followed by fatigue, weight loss, and poor appetite. After a shingles diagnosis and a course of valacyclovir, her symptoms persisted. 6 days before admission, fever developed. She was prescribed doxycycline and benzonatate, but shortness of breath worsened after completing treatment. Chest CT showed diffuse bilateral ground glass opacities. Despite antibiotics, her condition declined. Given the subacute course, history of zoster, and imaging findings, clinicians pursued testing for opportunistic infections. HIV testing revealed advanced HIV infection. A bronchoalveolar lavage specimen tested positive for pneumocystis jirovecii, and fungal culture grew Cryptococcus neoformans. She responded well to treatment. This case underscores the importance of assessing risk factors and maintaining vigilance for HIV and other sexually transmitted infections in older adults. The hypertension control paradox. Why is America stuck? A perspective by Sandeep Kishore from the University of California, San Francisco, and Robert Coker from Stanford Medicine, California. Although controlling blood pressure with medications is one of medicine's simplest and most effective interventions, the U.S. health system's efforts to combat hypertension population-wide have stalled. Guidelines exist and clinicians are trained, yet hypertension remains uncontrolled in half of Americans who have it. The authors argue that hypertension control is failing because of misaligned incentives, poor information flow, and ineffective care delivery. The authors believe that frontline clinicians act professionally and ethically, driven by intrinsic motivation. But the systems in which they work often direct investments away from critical, underfunded areas. A first step is for the government to extend payer time horizons by extending insurance policies to 3 to 5 years. Regulators and health plan leaders can redesign quality improvement efforts to focus on fewer, higher impact measures. Payers could reorient reimbursement toward outcomes rather than visits. Finally, healthcare organizations should make incentives team-based. Furthermore, timely and trustworthy data are the cornerstone of blood pressure control, but data are delayed, incomplete, or inaccessible, so clinicians can't trust the numbers they see or can't see them at all. Ultimately, the failure to control hypertension is a failure not of science, but of system design. To fix this, the authors call for incentives that reward prevention and sustained control of blood pressure, pursuing real-time data integration using AI and protocolized team-based care. The essential role of states in protecting immunization access. A perspective by Mandy Cohen from Manet Health, Washington, D.C., and co-authors. For decades, federal-state partnerships in the United States have supported one of the greatest public health achievements in history: widespread immunization against preventable diseases. This framework is now at risk. Recent federal policy shifts threaten to destabilize an interconnected system of vaccine access, weaken clinical guidance, and undermine public confidence. Although states cannot fully replicate federal authority or capacity, they can stabilize evidence-based policies and vaccine access when federal guidance becomes inconsistent. Several interrelated federal actions pose immediate risks. These include erosion of no-cost coverage for vaccines recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, potential instability in the Vaccines for Children program, and disruption of school and childcare vaccine requirements. Federal actions may also limit the authority of healthcare professionals and increase clinicians' liability concerns. An underappreciated shift has been ACIP's move from routine use recommendations to shared clinical decision-making, which can frame vaccines as optional. Beyond coverage and logistics, the most serious long-term threat may be erosion of trust in vaccines. States can act now to protect access to life-saving vaccines and mitigate these harms. Medicare's role in fighting chronic disease. A perspective by David Blumenthal from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston, and co-authors. Chronic diseases are widespread among Medicare beneficiaries, with 90% of Americans older than 65 years of age reporting at least one chronic condition, and 80% having multiple conditions. Although Medicare has made meaningful progress, access to care remains limited because beneficiaries are less likely than the populations of other high-income countries to have access to primary care, owing to workforce shortages and care that is often unaffordable. The authors call for reforms that strengthen primary care, expand access to appropriate preventive services, improve the affordability of care, and modernize Medicare's benefits. Suggested strategies include increasing primary care compensation, expanding value-based care arrangements, reducing administrative burdens, guaranteeing that every beneficiary has a dedicated PCP, capping out-of-pocket spending, eliminating cost-sharing for high-value chronic disease services, and expanding non-medical services such as nutrition, transportation, and lifestyle interventions to reduce the burden of chronic disease. Inheritance, a perspective by Eve Rittenberg from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston. Dr. Rittenberg comes from a line of Ashkenazi Jews who have intermarried for as long as a genetic ancestry kit can detect. At times, her connection to this family feels invented. She speaks no Yiddish, she's unsure of what towns her family came from, and she has only tenuous, dreamlike memories of her grandparents. 7 years ago, in an ongoing population study, Dr. Rittenberg was tested for the likely cause of her grandmother's ovarian cancer. The three founder BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic variants that speckle the Ashkenazi genes. Dr. Rittenberg knew that this set of variants in tumor suppressor genes reflected the imprint of some distant common ancestor and explained clusters of cancer and early deaths among Jewish people. And she received her negative result with relief. She thought she had emerged pristine out of her ancestral genetic ocean. But in 2025, an anonymous hospital number appeared on Dr. Rittenberg's cell phone, and a young voice rattled off words that seemed impossible. In Dr. Rittenberg's blood sample, donated several years earlier to a research database called the MGB Biobank, investigators had found a genetic mutation that increases the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. A few weeks later, the confirmed genetic diagnosis appeared in her patient portal. She had not escaped her grandmother's legacy after all. Dr. Rittenberg learned that BRCA2 is one of more than 50 genes that have actionable mutations. They increase the risk of disease, but there are effective interventions to reduce that risk. Once Dr. Rittenberg learned of her mutation, her calendar filled with medical appointments, exams, and surgery. The repercussions rippled outward onto her loved ones, whom she informed of their own risk. As both a patient and a primary care physician, Dr. Rittenberg is aware of how unlikely it was for her story to unfold in this way. Currently, only a tiny fraction of people with a high-risk family history obtain the recommended genetic testing. Clinical, institutional, and policy efforts are needed to facilitate screening in time for effective intervention. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 63-year-old woman with psoriatic arthritis presented with a 9-month history of pain in the left knee. A non-tender, palpable mass was present in the left popliteal fossa, which had a speech bubble shape on ultrasonography. A diagnosis of a Baker's cyst was made. Also known as a popliteal synovial cyst, a Baker's cyst results when synovial fluid from the knee joint flows into and accumulates in the gastrocnemius semimembranosus bursa. Baker cysts are associated with underlying joint disorders, including osteoarthritis, traumatic injury, or inflammatory arthritis, as in this case. In another image, a 55-year-old woman with invasive ductal carcinoma of the breast presented with a rash that had developed after a round of chemotherapy and had worsened and spread to her axillae, groin, and popliteal fossae after several additional rounds. Toxic erythema of chemotherapy was diagnosed and refers to a spectrum of chemotherapy-induced non-allergic skin reactions. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Tell us what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.